here at 8:30. Anything else I need to administratively? Is that it? Okay. We're going to go right back to our list and continue down the development area discussion. We're now on the something called DCI, Commercial Industrial Development Zone, which is approximately a 90-acre property just to the west of Route 6 and 15 in the vicinity of East Outlet on the lake. I think some of you may recall this is an area where you rezoned for a sawmill several years ago. Never came to fruition, so I don't know if you have any questions. I think it, in looking at it, it's pretty straightforward. There really aren't any substantive changes, if I'm correct, from what had been originally proposed. So. It's a little south of that, I think, but I don't think it's on that map, so. Oh, yes, it is. Yeah, I'm sorry, it is. There you go.
I'll ask a question.
Good.
With respect to the land use zoning and what you're proposing there, what do you see as the significance of that, I guess, beyond maybe the obvious?
What we're recommending, the only change we're recommending here to the proposal in this zone is the land use zoning, where we are suggesting, currently Plum Creek is proposing to freeze or fix into the plan the list of permitted uses for the DCI zone, the commercial industrial zone that is currently in Chapter 10. And what we are suggesting is rather than having that fixed list of permitted uses, instead referencing the DCI zone as it may change from time to time. Now, in my recollection, I don't believe that the permitted uses have changed, certainly not in recent history, but there may be a need in the future to modify the list of permitted uses in that DCI zone to clarify or accommodate new unanticipated industrial uses. And we simply don't feel that there is a need to administratively create a separate commercial industrial zone separate from LURC's current Chapter 10.
Agon, under a development review process, the only substantive change from the Plum Creek proposal to the staff and consultant proposal seems to be the last few words there. It says, as modified by pertinent recommendations. Could you just explain what that is?
Sure. This was just to highlight the fact that staff and consultants are making recommended changes to the so-called pocket part of the land use standards. And specifically, we're recommending changes to things like the scenic impact standards, Q3, the subdivision layout and design standards. And also, we want to... if we get to the point of going through a second tier list of issues, there may be additional implementation edits that we might want to recommend making changes to that pocket part. So this is just highlighting for you that the land use standards would apply to this zone as Plum Creek is currently proposing. But we are also making some recommendations to change some of those standards.
I don't see anybody else jumping in, so I think we can move on to the Route 615 development area just north of the DCI. I think it was the same map. There we go, yeah. This is an area where you're moving into now a two-step approval process at the subdivision level, right?
Right. This is an example of an area where we feel the acreage is large enough and there is enough excess capacity that it warrants looking at this development area as a whole through a long-term development plan process that we're recommending.
It has enough excess land, is that what you said?
Right. Approximately 125 units are targeted for this area, and there are more or less 930 buildable acres here. So this is an area that is a receiving area. It could potentially have more than 125 units developed here, and there is enough land there to our senses to warrant looking at the circulation pattern as a whole rather than through a piecemeal subdivision by subdivision review.
Okay. Do you have some sense of where these four water access points are?
Yes, I can highlight the
rather limited waterfront there, isn't it?
There is very limited water frontage here. There's an area here with some fairly poor soils, but we were envisioning the potential for one or two water access points here, as well as on the Moosehead Shore frontage here.
Isn't that area right there just surrounded by residential development already?
This area here?
Yeah. Isn't that already developed up through there?
Yes, there is quite a bit of residential development here as well as in this area and on Sandbar Tract. We're envisioning that there would be a water access point, maybe perhaps a commercial water access point here in the southern portion of this zone. This is actually one of the few places that Plum Creek has a viable water access point for Moosehead Lake. Mm-hmm. So we're envisioning that one or two water access points would be down here, perhaps one here and one here, depending on soil suitability and other site constraints.
Wasn't this the area where we had some issues with a game, an old game sanctuary or game preserve state initiated? Were those issues dealt with then, in effect?
What you were referring to is the status of this development area as well as other portions of the Moosehead Lake lands between Route 6 and 15 and the Moosehead Lake shore frontage along this corridor that I believe through statute has been identified as a game sanctuary, meaning that no hunting is allowed. and several witnesses, along with a number of members of the public, raised concerns about the level of development being proposed for this zone in the context of that designation as a game sanctuary. And we are not making any recommendations with respect to that status, and I will defer to Jerry to explain why that is the case.
My conclusion was that law is not a bar to development within the designated game sanctuary. It governs hunting and trapping in the area, but there is development there, and there has been development since the time that the game sanctuary was created.
Okay. Thank you, Jerry. Anybody else? Rockwood? Blue Ridge?
Can you show us quickly the proposed removals from this area?
The only removals from this area are, they're quite minor, and they involve the southwestern corner of this zone where IFNW and MNAP identified a waterfowl and wading bird habitat, and you will see reference to that same habitat when we get to the Brassway Peninsula. I believe it kind of straddles both of those development areas, and we are recommending removing that habitat as well as a 250-foot buffer around it from development zoning.
What about the north point of the peninsula?
We're looking at the Rockwood Blue Ridge area right now. We are making some recommended changes to the south peninsula that we'd be happy
to. Yeah,
that's
a separate area.
Separate issue, gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. The other recommendation that we're making is removing from MGNM zoning the ridgeline of Blue Ridge, which is this yellow area here, and placing that into conservation.
So that would become part of the easement, is that what you're saying?
Right, into the
and that would be,
easement.
But it would be not contiguous with the easement, right?
It would be one of the places where we deviated from our cardinal rule on carve-outs. The reason being is that we felt that this area was inappropriate for development because of the presence of that ridgeline, the presence of, I believe, some unique natural resource values there. I'd have to look back.
As an MGN zone, it couldn't be developed anyway, could it, if it's MGN?
It couldn't be developed per se, but it could become the back lot. It could become a portion of a back lot for a residential development that is within the development areas. So it could still be part of a parcel, and we did not feel that that was an appropriate means to protect the resources on site, particularly that given that that is a ridgeline and there may be risk of clearing for views.
Yeah, okay.
I believe, can I jump in here? With respect to the configuration of the zone along the west outlet. I believe one of the suggestions was to actually increase that buffer along the west outlet on that side of the road or the river, and also on the other side, I guess, a little bit further on the north end. You're thinking along the lines with respect to not including that is?
The reason that was recommended, and I believe that recommendation came from David Publicover, who was a witness with the Appalachian Mountain Club. And if I'm recalling this correctly, he had recommended expanding the balance easement in this area as well as in the Route 6 and 15 corner on the other side to increase protection, to provide for added visual protection for the west outlet. We looked very carefully at this area, and Fred Todd actually went on site to see what kind of visibility one could get from this is also called Long Pond. I'll refer to it as the Little Long Pond. And our sense was that the buffer being proposed here adequately protects the viewshed of the west outlet. There's also quite a bit of development on Little Long Pond already, where we felt that even if there were an incursion of some visible development through a filtered view, that would not be egregious. So we did not feel that there was that the expansion of this easement area was warranted.
Okay. How wide is that band as it is shown there?
It's a quarter mile on the north side, and I believe a half a mile on the southern side.
The one thing that strikes me about both this zone and the one we just did is that we're proposing not really a lot of units for very large parcels. And I'm trying to remember how that all came to be. I think so there's not really all that much developable land there. And I, maybe talk about that just a little bit.
Yes, Commissioner, if I may, there actually is a lot of developable land here. This is one of the very large development areas based on S.W. Cole soil surveys, which is not high intensity entirely, so this is only an estimate, but there are probably in excess of 2,400 buildable acres in this development area. But the development area consists of four distinct parts that you can see somewhat in the coloration. One part that's Braswa lake-oriented, a part that's hillside-oriented, some this way, quite a bit towards Moosehead, a part that is up by the dam, and then Rockwood Village oriented. So, in a sense, they're different kinds of places. I guess staff and we weren't troubled by the fact that it's large. It's kind of diverse and provides fair opportunities. It's pretty well located. What you will see in the recommendations as a result of the size, though, is a requirement that at least half of it be set aside for consideration beyond the 30-year period. We don't specify which half, but as part of the long-term development plan, the applicant would need to come in and indicate. And if the commission believes that this is in fact an appropriate place for development, we don't think it would be efficient land use to allow the 160 lots that are proposed here or whatever else might be here because it's a receiving area to expand to fill the land available. This should be treated as if it's appropriately located, it should be treated as a precious resource for very long-term needs beyond this concept plan. And so I've suggested that 50% be reserved for future consideration by the commission and future generations.
So, Evan, I'm sorry, did you say that you had thoughts on where that 50% would be or how it should be allocated, or you're sort of leaving that up to the applicant?
We would leave it up to the applicant to propose that as part of a long-term development plan to the commission. We do think that it should not be Swiss cheese kind of leftover land, but it should be blocks of land that could be well planned and developed in the future. But where that would be, we would leave that up to the long-term development review process.
And does it have to be set aside for the 30-year period of the plan, at which point it can then be developed, is that?
Yes, then okay. It would be up to the commission 30 years hence to decide how to zone that.
Chair Harvey, if I may, this may be a good place to contextualize the recommendations that the staff and consultants are making with respect to the long-term development plan, because this is really the area where that flagged the need for us, both in terms of the efficient use of land and the reservation of some of these excess lands. So if you're okay with that, I...
Go ahead.
I would like to pass the baton to Evan to kind of go over that. And that's on page 58 of the recommendations.
Are you going to talk a little bit about the difference between excess land and undeveloped land, since the rules appear to be somewhat different?
Yes. You'll recall, as I think was mentioned this morning, that several months ago we did, in view of the large size of some of these areas, an excess land analysis, which was based on our assumptions. This is nothing that Plum Creek has indicated would be quote-unquote excess. But we did look at different scenarios of development that are typical of concept plans or that would be typical of maybe a very large lot kind of scenario, just to try to understand how much land may never need to be incorporated into the proposed development. We know that a lot of this area has been proposed to be zoned the way it is to give the applicant lots of leeway in locating and designing development, and we understand the importance of that. Nevertheless, there would be significant opportunity to squander this land by cutting up into Swiss cheese kind of portions, or to have excessive lot sizes and so forth, and hem in the future, which in an appropriately located area we don't think is appropriate. So that's what we call excess land, is land that is not required to be incorporated into the development plans for this 30-year period. In several areas, and on page 58, we indicate them: Brassway Lake, South Peninsula, Rockwood, Blue Ridge, Route 615 corridor, Moose Bay, Lily Bay, and Big Moose Mountain, the latter two being potential resorts. Those areas are large enough to suggest to us that there will be a phasing of development. And that phasing of development will want to have the various pieces lock into each other in some logical way, because there will be need for circulation that connects. There will be need for open space that connects. There will be need for on-site recreational amenities that connect. And the very typical way of doing this is through a long-term development plan. This is true everywhere, that there are large-scale developments. This is not unique to this jurisdiction or to what we are proposing here. That once the first subdivision comes in, it needs to be preceded by or concurrent with an indication of what the long-term development plan is, so that these basic systems of utilities and circulation and open space and wildlife corridors and so forth, it can be shown how these all connect in a logical way. So the long-term development plan for these six areas, two of which have been designated by the applicant as resort areas, will have to go through this process in which they, in the interest of efficient land use, in the interest of making sure that there are some on-site recreational opportunities that will relieve some of the pressure from some of the off-site recreational opportunities in the interest of habitat preservation, which will relieve some of the pressures that we might otherwise be concerned about, that all those things are taken into account. And there will be some submission requirements for that long-term development plan that includes baseline descriptions of soils and natural resources and scenic areas and so forth, basically constraints and opportunities kinds of map, indications of how community services will be provided to these developments over the long term, and so forth. And you'll see on page 59 and 60 what we see as those submission requirements. And I needn't go through all of that unless you have questions on them, but these are quite typical. And there are, you'll see on page 60, some additional submission requirements if the area is a resort. Finally, you will see that in two areas here at Rockwood Blue Ridge, which we're talking about now, and on Braswa Peninsula, Southern Peninsula, that those areas are so large compared with the development that's proposed that we are proposing that a percentage, 50% here, 25% at Braswa, be set aside for the 30-year period so that the commission at that time can decide along with the landowner and parties of interest what the proper zoning and use of those areas should be. Does that put it in context sufficiently for you?
At Braswire and Rockwood, the only ones that you have this specific requirement for set-aside?
That's right.
Specified, anyway.
That's right. The other areas, we expect there will be excess land that
right.
is not incorporated into any development plan or subdivision, and that would similarly be treated. But these two areas are so large compared with the amount of development proposed that, and assuming that the commission believes that these are appropriately located places, that that area, given that everything else is going to be permanently conserved forever and there will be no other opportunities, that these should be regarded as important land to mm-hmm. husband.
Okay. Gwen?
I am assuming that any discussion we're going to have about specific permitted uses and lot sizes, minimum lot sizes, we're reserving for the next part of this these deliberations.
No,
but I don't see anything in here, right? Is that correct?
We have. Let me address those two issues separately because I think they're addressed in different ways. With respect to lot sizes, we are making a recommendation, and this will come up under the discussion of 1025Q3 to eliminate language that Plum Creek proposes that gives the applicant the discretion to determine lot sizes. We do not feel that that's appropriate, and we do firmly believe that the commission needs to retain its discretion to interpret the concept, the comprehensive plan policy on lot sizes. Either at the long-term development planning stage or at subsequent subdivision review stage. So that is embedded in the recommendation related to 1025Q3. With respect to permitted uses, what we are recommending to you in the zoning structure section is a list of examples of uses that we feel would be appropriate. So to the extent that you have concerns about any of those uses or want to discuss them, I do think that this would be an appropriate time to do so. For example, there has been a lot of controversy and concern raised about a golf course at Lily Bay or a marina at Lily Bay. Our recommendation, as you will see in the resort optional zone, would be to allow those uses, but to constrain them in the manner that has been set forth in that area, meaning a criterion or a standard that limits their size, potentially, but not per se prohibit that use to the extent that the commission has concerns about that. I do think that it would be appropriate to have a discussion on permitted uses now as opposed to later in the process.
You say you want to talk about permitted uses right now on this?
I'm just saying now as opposed to putting them in the category of second-tier
issues. Oh, okay. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, that answers my question. That's what I was trying to find
and
out.
And the appropriate place for that may be when we get back, when we circle back to the zoning framework, which we're almost there.
Okay.
Okay.
Anything else on Rockwood Blue Ridge? Brassway?
This is an area that also caused me some heartache. It has to do particularly with the peninsula. And I guess my concern was I saw this as a real transition area between the sort of Brassway, the developed area in Brassway, and the Moose River, the northern part of Moose River that runs out of Long Pond. And I was very much concerned about trying to preserve the character of the Moose River, I guess you'd say west of Brassway. And I was really concerned about having a really intensive development on that peninsula because as you come down the Moose River, you look right at that peninsula. And I guess I feel a little bit more comfortable now with the proposal to have some buffering. That's at least that's what I understand that the green to be is essentially a buffered area that would allow for more of that transition. I was really concerned about the intensity of development on that peninsula. However, looking at that in the context of the development along the South Shore, the concept plan, which we approved for the North Shore a couple of years ago, I mean, I think the class of the lake, I mean, it just seems, and I guess given the fact, and we haven't gotten there yet, but these somehow are all, it's difficult to parse these out into isolated areas, but as we're going to get to the proposal of limiting development on Long Pond, particularly the North Shore, I think if that occurs, then I could accept some of this development on the Brassway Peninsula, but I have to say this is another one of those places that I don't know what I'm going to do about it yet, but I mean it's causing me a little, there's some real concerns here about that, and I just want to make that clear up front.
The I'd like to go to the issue of the transferability of this one states it's capped. But then there's a footnote 44 which talks about this could be a receiving area, and there was one other reference in here that kind of implied that it was a receiving area. So I'm kind of, can you? Enlighten me a little bit?
Sure. This is the one area, the capped area, that we have identified as a place with apparently enough developable acreage, even with the carve-out recommendations that we're making, where additional development might be able to be accommodated. We're recognizing this area as already being proposed for quite a bit of intensive development and see it and view it as appropriate for that level of intensity of development. So although we're not making any explicit recommendation to increase the cap here, we just wanted to flag for the commission that in terms of the total number of units here, the intensity of development being proposed is not an issue for the staff and consultants here.
Right.
and that this could be, if the commission wished to view it that way, this could be an extension of the Rockwood development area and might have some potential to be another receiving area or have some opportunity for a set-aside of excess lands beyond 30 years.
Right.
Did you want to add anything?
This is the place, I guess, where we need to talk about where the line is or with the removal of some of the development shorefront is. And is it would you say it's at the little peninsula at the very toe of the boot there?
Yes, on page 41, there's a hand-drawn map. It's not
right
official, and that line should not be taken as the gospel. But I'll tell you what the governing intent is. Yes, could you toggle back and forth between the two, Amy?
So it looks like and I'm not sure what that pencil line arrow underneath the limit of lots thing says, but it looks like it's pointing at that peninsula that I spoke of.
That's right.
Whereas the line is going somewhere else.
Right. What we're suggesting is that the view corridor coming out of Little Braswa would be defined by a ridge line that runs roughly up here to this peak and then down. So it's a little bit more than the green area there, and it would come off to this to a tip about there.
Okay.
At that point, if you can toggle back now.
Do you have some way to...
At that point, you can see we've drew in some view corridors from different vantage points, a little Braswa, and at that point, any development from that point over would probably not be visible.
Yeah. My question is, how are you going to find that on the ground?
It's very doable to GPS or to mark it in the same way that many of the other conservation easements. This would be put into balance easement, this area.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be located.
Okay, that's the intent would be to put all everything up to the view corridor demarcation, I guess, if you will, would go to balance easement.
To balance easement, whatever it is. And I think, I'm not sure it's this. This may be overstated. It might be, you know, you come up a little bit of the side slope there and so forth, but that can be more precisely defined.
Well, I guess the idea is that somebody sitting on the water can't see over the top of the ridge line, basically.
That's right.
So everything on the other side of the ridge line is not visible.
That's right.
And this was a real issue with the guides who were using this area canoeing.
That's
up
right.
Through here, not to be facing development all the way up.
Are you clear on that, Ed, or is that?
Yes.
Okay. You want to just comment on the, you talked about in some parts of the development having limited shoreline structures and in another area no limits. I assume this is a scenic issue, but could you just clarify that, please?
Yeah, the limitations on the shoreline structures here was... I'm sorry, I'm blanking. I want to say it was soils-based, but frankly, I do need to look back to my notes on this and check what the rationale was here for the limitation. So if we could defer that question, I will get back to you with an answer.
All right, we'll let you do that.
Thank you.
The only other thing I wanted to mention about this area that might help you is that it is a very large area. It's a very important area, but it's a very large area. There's probably on the order of 1,500 acres of developable soils, even after you carve out the wetland area, significant wildlife habitat and so forth. And that's about 2.5 square miles. And though it might seem like a lot of development, 250 is a lot. The intensity is not great, but it's a lot of development, but it's not intense given that kind of... And so here is where one of the areas we've suggested that the long-term development plan should identify consciously where some excess land might lie and let the future commission decide about that.
Okay.
Evan, is the different the 25% being set aside simply a function of, as compared to the 50%, just of developable land as
that,
a ratio?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Would you please explain the ability for commercial development to take place? I know there was some concern. I think it was Moosehead Futures had some concerns about the types of commercial activity that might take place in this area. I noticed that you say allow neighborhood scale commercial facilities and uses by special exception. Could you just explain what that means?
Yes, this is related to the discussion we had earlier. The concern in part was the proposed DGN zones that are in a golden color there in the Plum Creek proposal. And those are not small geographic areas. I can't remember exactly how large they are, but there's probably over 200 acres total in both of them. And the idea was that they would float. They weren't sure where they should go until they get to a detailed layout of this development area so that they would float. Here is where we have gone to more of a modest mixed-use idea in which there's no reason not to allow certain convenience kinds of services, goods and services, scaled down to what we're calling neighborhood level, but it, you know, 2,500 square foot style or smaller kinds of businesses. It could be little artisan shops, it could be convenience stores, it could be those sorts of things. And we limit the aggregate area of that. First of all, it would come in by special exception, so they would have to come before the commission to demonstrate what's being proposed and its justification that it will not have adverse effects. But secondly, the acreage aggregate is limited to 50 acres throughout. So there might be it might end up being in a little core area, or there might be it might be in a couple or a few different places.
50 acres throughout what?
Throughout this whole South Brasswood Peninsula development area.
The peninsula.
Yes, no more than 50 acres of land would be able to be devoted to this purpose. And even that is large. That's only for leeway. You know, a neighborhood center or a convenience center that would be justified by the market here and that would be good best practices for this kind of development probably is not going to require more than 5 or 10 acres.
I was pleased to see that your footnote has laid out what examples of what those things might be. It seems to me at the hearings, people were concerned that there were going to be nursing homes and things that sounded rather large, but the neighborhood scale and the list of possibilities, I think, puts it in perspective.
Yeah, our approach with respect to the neighborhood scale uses was to really try to model it as much as possible on LURC's current DGN zone that allows for a range of commercial uses but limits the size of those uses to a square footage maximum. Chair Harvey, I found the response to your previous question on docks, if you want to entertain me for a minute. The basis for recommending a limitation here was actually not due to soil constraints. The soils here are quite good and the shoreline access is quite good as well, and Dave Roque did not have any recommended restrictions. However, Jim Palmer, in looking at the scenic as part of his scenic assessment, did recommend and state that the introductions of docks here ought to be minimized so as to not change the visual character of this lake or move it into more of a rural ROS class. So that was the basis for our recommendation to limit the number of docks on the peninsula.
Aga, following up on that, the Rockwood Blue Ridge shore, that's no limitation. The northeast shore is no limitation, but the peninsula is.
The Northeast Shore has no limitation because of the water access only aspect of that development. And the Rockwood Shore probably should have a limitation on it. That was an oversight. In retrospect, we probably should be restricting for that same reason the number of access points. The shoreline there is very limited, and I think, if I remember correctly, we're talking about this area here. I think it can only accommodate two or three lots because of the limited shore frontage. I can check back on that, but it may be a non-issue because of the size and the amount of shore frontage.
Aga, you need to speak right up, please.
Okay, I'm
sorry. I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Commissioner Schaefer was reflecting, was asking why we were not recommending any limitations on docks and water access points here. And the reason is that this is a development area that we do think is appropriate, but it is all a water access only area. So it seems logical to allow for that on each parcel. And on this portion of the Rockwood shoreline, the Rockwood development area that is on Brassway, my recollection, and I will need to double check this, is that there is very limited shorefront available for development here due to the nature of the road accessing there. So I think there's already a natural limitation to the amount of shorefront access that would be available there. But I will certainly check back on that.
I had a question. I don't know if it's something that will be discussed at this level or the next tier, but I'm mentally sort of adding up the number of potential launch areas as we've gone through the day, and I'm thinking about each one of them as being a vector for invasive species. And I'm wondering, will those all be... I'm just wondering, I guess I'm concerned that those launches be somehow specifically included in the invasive plant, invasive species and wildlife protection fund, that as we add these, that they are, you know, the effort is made to ensure that they don't become a liability from an invasive species, and that somehow funding, that the funding be recognized, that the increase in launches and somehow address that.
Okay, got it. Thanks.
Okay, anything else on Brassway? Long Pond. I guess the major change here, obviously, was the recommendation that the North Shore be removed from the development zone, and a few other adjustments to recognize some wetland areas on the South Shore. Other than that, the recommendations look like they're in line with all of the others in terms of zoning designation and how we view the process, et cetera. So, anybody have any comments on Long Pond?
Well, I just say that if I recall the record correctly, the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, as well as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, gave some pretty specific testimony here with regard to the adverse impacts that such development on the North Shore of Long Lake would have. I mean, there's some unique habitat. There are deer, wildlife traverse areas. I mean, and in my history as a regulator, I have very rarely seen the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife be so specific in terms of their recommendation that no development take place. So I think that the record strongly supports removing these two areas. Again, I'm referring to the two areas in the north shore of Long Pond. So, I mean, I think that that's pretty well established in the record, or supported in the record.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree, Ed. There's a pretty, the record is pretty clear about this one, and there wasn't just wildlife. There were other. There was a huge wetland up there, natural areas program. Then, of course, the archaeological concerns as well. So,
the number of residential units total was cut in half. Was that because of the dropping the two southern areas?
That's right. Originally, Plum Creek was targeting somewhere in the range of 55 to 70 units on the North Shore, and we are recommending cutting that in half. We think that actually 55 units is probably not achievable on the South Shore because of the site constraints on that area. However, As you will see when we talk about the total number of units, we're not making a recommendation to cut the total number of units in the plan down. What we are envisioning here is that those 55-plus units that cannot be accommodated on Long Pond be transferred to other places, such as the receiving areas that are identified in our recommendations.
Of those 55, those were waterfront lots. Is, in the context of the receiving areas, is there any room to make up that difference or not?
It's fairly limited. I think the one place that may have potential room would be at the Brassway South Peninsula, and that might actually require the commission to consider scaling back its dimensional requirements with respect to shore frontage, minimum shore frontage requirements. So, for example, if you wanted to assure that the lost value to Plum Creek on the North Shore be replaced equivalently by shorefront units, some portion of those may be located on, might be able to be accommodated in the Brassway South Peninsula. But my sense, and this is sort of a back of the envelope kind of estimate, is that in order to accommodate all 55 shorefront units, you might need to reduce the minimum shore frontage requirement below what is currently proposed, which is 150 feet.
Isn't it true, though, that the uncapped areas provide opportunity, certainly for replacement of the acreage?
Absolutely, yes.
But it's the amenities, the shorefront.
Yeah, there is plenty of excess lands to accommodate an acre-per-acre replacement of these units in other areas, you know, Rockwood, Beaver Cove, Moose Mountain area, et cetera. I was just highlighting that in terms of shore frontage, it is fairly limited, and this plan over the course of the 3 years has transitioned from a shorefront-focused development plan to one that is much more constrained with respect to shorefront development.
You might have to look at clustering and uncommon docks in that case. I didn't realize that. Is it the revised Chapter 10 that gives the 150 feet of shore frontage
rather
than 200?
Yeah, in the addendum to Chapter 10 that Plum Creek is proposing, Section 1027B, Section 1026, includes some modifications to the dimensional requirements, and one of those proposed changes involves a reduction of shore frontage down to 150
feet. And
that's
for all of their shorefront
lots? For all of the shorefront lots. Hmm.
And I feel compelled to say that I have mentioned that I have some concerns about this. I think that, you know, given that we're dealing with a concept plan which specifically reserves shorefront from development, that the frontage limitation that we use generally throughout the jurisdiction may not be as warranted, as long as there are substantial design requirements also in place to ensure that within the developable area we don't get, you know, maximum shorefront linear development. I mean, that's what we've tried to avoid. So as long as that is coupled with some real design criteria that represent clustered development, and again, I'm not a planner, and I don't know exactly what that should look like, then I just want to, as long as this has come up, I just want to state that I have some real concerns about that, because we have approved in the past in other concept plans very close to this area supposed cluster development, and as we flew over the areas, I didn't see much evidence of cluster development. So I guess what I'm worried about is not so much the concept of limiting or allowing for a reduced shorefront area, but just how that's going to be implemented and what that bodes for precedents for the future. I guess those are my...
This may be a good place to highlight for you our recommendations with respect to 1025Q and the subdivision layout and design standards, which I think goes right to the points that you're making, Commissioner Laverty. So
okay. What page are you on?
This is on page 62.
Page 62.
Right. And I won't reiterate this, but our view essentially is that there are several purposes to the layout and design standards that we see are important and need to continue as part of a subsequent development within this concept plan area. However, there is one that we feel has been effectively achieved or would be effectively achieved through the proposed conservation measures, and that is the protection of undeveloped shoreline. So to the extent that the commission, as it reviews incremental subdivision proposals on lakes, has relied on Section 1025Q3 to, again, avoid that ring around the lake phenomenon and preserve, for all kinds of purposes, open space on the shoreline, we feel that the conservation measures here on each of the lakes targeted for development achieve that purpose, and for that reason, we are much less concerned about a development pattern, for example, on Brassway Lake, that may have significant segments of lengths of shoreline development on the peninsula, rather than the broken up designs that may otherwise emerge as a result of interpreting 1025Q3. In the absence of a concept plan framework.
I guess the design criteria, which I haven't had a chance to look at, I mean, I know that we now have a policy that's directed towards cluster development. I understand the proposal here is to remove the village center concept from that. Is that correct?
That is Plum Creek's proposal. That's not what staff is recommending.
That's not you're recommending retaining that village concept cluster development.
We're recommending reinstating the language of Section 1025Q3 as it currently exists.
Okay.
However, we wanted to highlight for you that in the context of interpreting that within this concept plan, we see one of the three objectives of those standards as having been met through the conservation elements of the plan. So again, for example, looking at Brassway Lake, the objective of trying to preserve shoreline, we feel, is better met at the landscape scale as opposed to on that peninsula. And that would allow for a more compact development pattern that in some cases might involve incremental shorefront development within that development area. But we have assurances through the conservation components that that will not be a development pattern that infuses the entire lake.
Right, and again, I'm willing to acknowledge that. I guess I'm just a little bit jaded in that we've been advocating cluster development, and I haven't really seen much of it. And I guess, I don't know why that's the case. And I just would like to make sure that if we're going to make this exception, that we understand that it isn't just based on a reduction in shore frontage, mm-hmm. It's based on a reconceptualization of how residential units along a lakefront should be developed.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. For example, I would not be an advocate of applying this interpretation of the Q3 standards to a future subdivision that may come in before the commission, because that objective of preserving open space might not be achieved in the context of incremental subdivision review. And what we're trying to highlight is that in this context, with this concept plan, it makes sense to us to focus the design standards on the kinds of goals and objectives that we've laid out in the long-term development plan recommendations, meaning efficient use of land, good circulation patterns, a connectivity and a wholeness to the development scheme, rather than a prescriptive approach of trying to preserve 500-foot stretches of open space within a development area in the context of a lake that is otherwise protected from development.
Right, and I wouldn't want to go to the other extreme, encouraging the development of Kingdom shorefront lots either. Right. I mean, I think we ought to be emphasizing the conservation of development land.
Right, and that's a very good point, and this is where we were making the recommendation that I referred to earlier with Commissioner Hilton's question on lot size discretion. We do feel it's quite important for the commission to retain its ability to decide what lot sizes are and are not appropriate in the context of a long-term plan. And to us, that doesn't mean that all of the lots have to be one-acre lots.
Right.
To the contrary, the land should dictate what those lots ought to be.
Well, part of my willingness to go along with your recommendation on Upper Wilson Pond is my assumption that the design characteristics for that development will be based on cluster development, village. Is that a fair assumption on my part?
Upper Wilson is not an area that we're recommending be part of the long-term development plan simply because of the number of units being proposed. You may want to consider adding that if that is an important element to your thinking.
Well, what would be the shorefront restrictions on development in Upper Wilson Pond? What would be the required
The minimum shorefrontage?
Right.
Right now, what Plum Creek is proposing and that we're not objecting to is a minimum 150-foot shorefront requirement.
But with no cluster development?
Let me step back a little bit, because cluster development in the context of LURC regulations is very different than what it means from a planning perspective.
Well, I'm not sure I know in either context, so enlighten me, please.
The clustering provisions in the LURC Chapter 10 really only mean one thing. They incentivize but do not require smaller lots, and they allow for example, development on a common shorefront or commonly owned parcel so that you could get a more tightly knitted development pattern, but there is no requirement to do that anywhere. The only requirement that exists is in places like on Class 4 lakes, where a preservation of shore frontage and net developable acreage is required as sort of a set aside of open space, which doesn't necessarily lead to, you know, the village type clustered development vision that that kind of the planning practice might have in mind.
Well, I don't want to beat this to death, but I mean, I'm a little confused. How do we then prevent linear development along the shore with 110-foot frontage?
Front. You don't necessarily prevent it, and we're not recommending that you prevent it. What we are recommending is that that the standards that currently apply to development, meaning the community center objectives, still apply.
As recommendations or as requirements?
As requirements.
Oh,
okay. And minimum shore frontage requirements would exist as well.
I guess I misunderstood. I thought you said that they were voluntary. They were recommended design, but weren't required.
The voluntary component of our current Chapter 10 standards involve clustering in the true sense of the word, meaning common shore frontage and a density of development that is below the minimum dimensional requirements. And when I think of clustering, that's the vision that I have in my mind. So I probably muddled the issue even more. But I did want to make a distinction between what clustering means in the LURC regulations and what it means to planning practice, which I think is quite
different.
So
the units that are proposed for Upper Wilson Pond will end up being sited in a linear fashion along Upper Wilson Pond?
The units proposed at Upper Wilson Pond could include a linear component, like any development could right now in LURC jurisdiction, so long as it also includes a community center. And in order to meet that community center standard, there needs to be a form and a function between a relationship between the community center
but anywhere
and
else
the
in
units.
LURC jurisdiction, you're not allowed to do 150-foot shore frontage, right?
The 150-foot shore frontage is a change to the dimensional requirements. You're absolutely right.
Okay. Well,
that would be changed.
I don't want to get way sidetracked on this, but
I think we're hearing you, Commissioner Laverty. I just do want to note what you've acknowledged, and so I don't want to restate the obvious, except that if you think about this as we have at two levels, one is the resource level, the lake level,
right,
where the ring around the lake at Upper Wilson, for example, is simply impossible because they have put such a large percentage of it into conservation that if you think of clustering at the lake level, they've done it in spades. And then you come down to the site level. So you've taken care of the resource level. Now you've come down to the site level. And the question is, what should the standards be at the site level, given the 140 acres or whatever it is? I've got the actual number here, but that's from memory, of buildable area. How do 32 lots get arranged on that 140 acres and those many feet, which is a very small percentage of the entire shoreline? And even there, you want the thing to hang together, not to put undue pressure on the shore, allow a circulation system to work internally even for a 32-lot subdivision. And so that's where your questions come in. I think that it is entirely possible to have a 125-foot or 150-foot shoreline frontage and come up with a better design in that regard than simply to say everything's got to be 200 feet, let's say. And so that's, I think, that's why, as Aga mentioned, the hope is to give the commission some discretion when they review these things and some encouragement to the applicant to have some design that is simply not 32 lots strung along that remaining frontage.
Well, if that's the case, if that's the case, why say 150 feet? Why not say the frontage will be determined based on the design characteristics and the other opportunities for conservation that have already taken the characterization of the shorefront?
I'm all for flexibility in design. Sometimes, if you leave it completely open-ended, there may be it may be too much administratively. But I don't think there's anything magic about 150 feet. I think there is a minimum below which you shouldn't go simply
because...
What would
that be, do you think?
Oh, probably in shoreline context, it would be in the... I'm just pulling this out of the air. I'm making this up in a sense. But, you know, it would probably be in the 75, 80-foot, 90-foot range, enough so that there could be a winding pathway and some privacy with side yard setbacks, and you've already got the 100-foot buffer, which applies regardless of the width of the shoreline, so that 100-foot buffer will always be a visual analysis. But, you know, on these lots, you have to think about septic systems, and so there's got to be enough space for things. But in terms of the overall design of the subdivision itself, I don't think there's anything magic. We've tended to raise these numbers like 150 and 200 feet through shoreland zoning and through other things to some mystical level when it really isn't. Given this concept plan in which a huge percent of the entire shoreline is conserved, you could not have that if that weren't the case, because septic systems and nutrient flows and everything else would simply overwhelm the resource. But here, you're in a different situation.
I accept what you're saying. I still have a problem with this, a slight problem with it. And I just want to register that, because this is like the holism reductionism argument. I can understand in concept.
Yes.
And it sounds good at the landscape or the resource level. When you get down to designing, I mean, we've seen way too many lakes and ponds in the state of Maine where you've got tremendously concentrated, well, Brassway Lake. Right there, that southern shore of Brassway Lake. I mean, look at the concentration of development there. I mean, it's almost, and I hesitate to characterize this way, because I'm sure the owners of these camps will take offense, but it's almost like a ghettoized, you know, development. And I don't think it's fair to pick particularly low-income people that are going to be left with the narrow shorefront lots, and others are going to be, you know, have access to kingdom lots. This just seems to be a larger issue than it's being. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, we're hearing you.
Okay.
Can I jump onto that? I guess it's one that concerns me as well, particularly with the Brassawa Peninsula, and the reason there is we've got such a long shoreline. I mean, I don't even know how long that is. We're talking about 250 units, and I mean, it's just a long area. And I mean, I understand in principle what you're proposing, and it makes sense. But I'm just wondering if it isn't, you know, maybe in some instances more complex than that, you know, or that we need to look at it. The other thought with respect to the related to this is that that we need to talk about it a little bit more in general, what you're proposing with respect to the subdivisions. Shorefront subdivisions, and I guess that's pretty obvious based on comments. And it may be that some sketches on a pad or something might make it a little easier for us to understand what we're talking about here. The difference between, say, a cluster subdivision and what our rules say and conservation subdivisions. There's some concepts here that I don't know. It might be a way to approach it.
That's a good suggestion. Let me just add that a variety of things come into play here when you're talking about shorefront minimums and so forth. But when you combine, I'll just put this out, not to negate or even argue, because we're listening and not arguing at all. But when you combine the shoreline buffers, vegetative buffers that you have, and you combine that with the suggested limitations on on docks. It'd be one thing if you had 125 or 150 foot frontages and everybody had a dock.
Agreed.
That's very different than if you had 125 frontages and you only saw 10 common docks stretched over a mile or a mile and a half. The image, the impact is just very different. Where the views are very filtered of the structure to begin with, and the evidence of development on the shore is limited by the common dock. There you've now mitigated two important things, and it simply makes the frontage requirement less important than it might otherwise be. That does not diminish your argument or thoughts about design of subdivision, because that's important for a whole bunch of other reasons as well. And hopefully 1025QR will allow the commission the discretion it needs to assure a sound design.
Yeah, Chair Harvey, what I might suggest is that we tee this discussion up for tomorrow, a continuation of this dialogue for tomorrow, where perhaps we'll have some opportunity to come up with some illustrations of these concepts that make this a little more meaningful.
Okay.
You can try that.
That'd be fine. I don't know. We lost Long Pond somewhere along the way.
Take us back to Long Pond.
Yeah. Have you got some more questions,
Glenn?
Yeah,
and this one's a pretty straightforward one. On page 44, This has to do with limitations of shoreland structures. And it says, it's the last line on the right-hand side, recommendations. No limitations recommended in the southwest shore area. Why? I guess it's the...
This is the very small development area being proposed right here. And the acreage and amount of shore frontage is very minimal. And it's really infill development to a pattern of development that extends along the entire length of the shoreline. And our sense was that there was no unique need here to limit the number of docks, for example, in that area. I think the area is targeted for 5 lots that are intermixed with a development pattern of you know, existing units, existing camps along here. And, you know, if you use the sort of the Jim Palmer discordant element principle, we've way crossed the line already on that portion of the lake.
There are no limitations, Commissioner, because it's self-limiting. It's a tiny little space.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on that long pond? Okay. That takes us, in my book, to total number of units. Probably no one's interested in this one, but... okay. The staff is, I think, prepared to talk us a little bit about this, if you wish them to, in terms of how they ended up with, you know, basically... you know, not making any changes here from what it was seen originally. If you'd like to hear some of their thinking before we start that, they can do that. So, Aga, who's going to do that?
I'm going to ask Evan to take the lead, and Ron and I may fill in as...
Okay, that would be fine. Thank you.
In some ways, we arrive at this through the kind of a sum of the parts analysis, where you look at each one individually and you think about what will work and what might not work, and you reach certain conclusions. But let me also come back at it from the other way, which is this idea of cumulative impact. And when you're thinking at this scale, how do you think about cumulative impact, and how can we be comfortable in recommending that the total number of units proposed is okay? Based on everything that's on the record. And I will emphasize that our conclusions come exclusively from what the record tells us. Is that me? The first question is cumulative impact on what? You know, what's the current character of the region that is being impacted and against which we should measure the future? And here it is, we felt it important in our internal discussions to move as far away as we could from the impressionistic subjective sense of what this area is, though that is, you can't do that entirely, and towards finding a mechanism for objective analysis as to what this area is. It's one of the reasons we went to Jim Palmer and Mark Anderson, for example, to help us understand, help the commission to understand what the character of the region is from an arm's length analytical point of view. And you will recall that a mechanism that they arrived at to describe this is the recreation opportunity spectrum, which is a mechanism used by the U.S. Forest Service and others to describe high-value recreational areas. And you'll recall that this is a spectrum that runs from urban settings at one end of the spectrum to primitive settings at the other end. And in the middle are different words and terms depending on the author, but they are semi-primitive settings of different kinds. There are rural settings of different kinds, rural developed, rural natural, roaded natural, that sort of thing, in the middle between these two ends. And the various consultants tended to characterize this overall area as roaded natural, that is sort of in the middle. It's not unlike what you would expect for an industrial forest. But overall, a roaded natural setting, and I'm just going from the notes, is a setting that has a modified appearance, but still natural appearing. An area where there are people, where there are the sights and sounds of civilization and human beings, but those sights and sounds usually are not out of harmony with the natural environment. Interactions among recreational users are low to moderate in these areas. Trail uses are managed, usually in designated corridors of various kinds. It is an area in which motorized and mechanized uses are common and expected, and an area that where timber harvesting is compatible with that setting. So if you were to characterize this overall area, according to the various consultants and other parties who testified along these lines, it would be characterized as sort of in the middle of that spectrum. It is not primitive. It is not wilderness. There are areas of this region that would be fall into the semi-primitive portions of that spectrum, such as Little Moose Mountain and portions of Sugar Island and certainly the Roaches and so forth. But that's the overall tone. There are also some areas that would be explicitly rural under this spectrum. Rockwood is explicitly rural. There are portions of some of the developed lakes here that are at the rural part of the spectrum. So if you accept that, and of course you have great discretion as to whether to accept that kind of metric or not, you then start to ask questions. You start to deconstruct all of the potential impacts and ask and study each of those individually. Scenic, recreational, forestry resources, wildlife, community services. And you ask the question, what does 2,000 plus or 2,025 or 2,325, depending on what all you're including in here, what will the cumulative impact of those things be on these various components of the landscape? And that's what we did. And I can answer questions about each of those areas if you would like. I can spend the next 3 hours talking about them if you'd like. I know you wouldn't. But suffice it to say that with respect to the scenic, we do believe that there will be areas that will shift in that spectrum from roaded natural or rural natural into more rural developed. There will be a shift within development areas and in some cases the adjacent lakes and areas of public value. But we think also that those can be mollified, and mitigated to a significant extent with the proper vegetation clearing standards and other standards that we have discussed and are proposing in our recommendations. We also believe that there will be and are other areas that through the conservation easements will be forever protected in their current state. And will not experience that kind of shift. With respect to recreation facilities, we also think that there will be some shift from the rural natural or eroded natural place on the spectrum to something that is more developed within the developed areas. This will happen unevenly. It will happen at Indian Pond. The east and west outlets will receive a greater use. But other areas will be embedded within the landscape level of this plan that will, in fact, be able to absorb and more than absorb some of the spillover without any change in character. There is not an awful lot of quantification in the record about this, but there is some. And so, for example, Dr. Daigle's analysis listed the many destinations that are today underused and even with more use would not lose their primitive recreational resource opportunities. So there is a place, there is ample area in our view for some of the recreational opportunities that will be lost in a place like the Big Moose Mountain area to shift elsewhere. Some of those will be close in, like Prong Pond. Some of them will be areas just beyond the concept plan area, like KI. Some of them will be within the concept plan area, like the Roaches and Spencer Bay. But there appear to be ample areas. One of the places, one of the parties that did try to quantify this was Maine Audubon NRCM's witness, Mr. Christ, who actually developed a set of formulas that were based on what he called logic and what he called worst-case scenario, because he had to assume the worst-case scenario in the absence of detail. But the bottom line to his analysis was that, taking into account all the development, not just at Lily Bay, but all the development throughout, he estimated that there might be, on an average summer day, something on the order of 300 vehicles striking out to the various, for various what he called wilderness recreational activities. That does not strike us as a cumulative impact that will overwhelm this area. When you think about all of the destinations to which, based on his reckoning, 300, it was actually fewer than 300 vehicles might go, there simply seems to be an awful lot of capacity in this 400,000-acre region to absorb that kind of activity. When you look at traffic, which is another way to think about cumulative impact, we had a great deal of testimony from witnesses on both sides of the issue. And we have talked about some of that cumulative impact earlier today. But suffice it to say that in the areas beyond the real developed areas, out into the wilderness areas, Cocajo points north, or up 20 Mile Road, or out the KI Road, there is no evidence that those vehicle counts will rise to a level that will be a significant threat to wildlife. We are concerned about wildlife impacts in the immediate area of Lily Bay, and you saw that in our recommendations with respect to that development area. But in the wilderness areas, as Mr. Christ called them, at north of Cocajo, for example, up Sias Hill Road or 20 Mile Road and so forth, those impacts simply do not seem to be so large that they cannot be absorbed within the development area. I'm glad to answer other questions and get in more detail. The impression I want to leave you with is that we carefully looked at the record in each of these functional areas of wildlife, forestry, recreation, visual impact, measured against the existing character of this area. And what people appear to value about this area. And we could not find evidence that the cumulative impact of the proposed units would exceed the carrying capacity of this area as a whole. We think there will be some shifts in specific development areas, and it is why the conservation easements, both the balance and legacy easements, are so important to absorbing that shift. Mark Anderson, our consultant, our recreation consultant, Jim Palmer, our scenic visual guy, and others testified to the importance of those as absorbing the shift, the dynamic shift that always goes on in the world of recreation, outdoor recreation. So that's a brief summary of how we went around this, about this process, and I think suffice to say we're quite confident that the area can absorb the impacts that are being offered here.
Mr. Chair, I just want to ask, add one concept to what Evan said. The analysis that we did was not an analysis based on development previously proposed at Big W, at Prong Pond, on the north shore of Brassway, on the north shore of Long Pond, on any number of remote units, on conservation that started at 11,000 acres, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's very important and deeply embedded in Evan's analysis was getting this amount of development in what we believe to be the right locations for the region. And those locations do not involve, in our view, as currently recommended, a sprawled rural development pattern in which these number of units are put out in a much different landscape picture than is being put out with the changes that Plum Creek made and the further recommendations that we've made.
Yeah, I'm glad Ron supplemented my comments with that, because we start out at the landscape level and where is the are these appropriate places for development? And there's been a long evolution over 3 or 4 years of those appropriate places. I want to say also we looked at other things. We looked at the question of boating traffic and these various elements and tried to square them with standards that the commission has. For example, on whether a water body, the surface acreage of a water body, faces overuse as a result of the amount of development. For the most part, I think universally you're way under the metrics that you have as a commission for that sort of thing. I'm going to leave it there. I'm not overly trying to convince you. That's not my purpose. What we want to say is we went through a systematic analytical process here to arrive at the conclusion as to whether this was acceptable within the criteria that you'll be measuring this concept plan by.
Just one final remark on this issue. I do want to highlight that our conclusion on the total number of units is very much dependent on and tethered to the recommendations we are making. So as Ron mentioned, the recommendations we are making with respect to the location of development is critical in terms of thinking about whether the total number of units is appropriate here. Likewise, our recommendations on the long-term planning approach, the scenic standards, et cetera, are quite tethered to our conclusion that if these recommendations are accepted, then we feel that the cumulative impacts will be adequately addressed and managed.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to say that I'm very pleased that Evan is involved in this project. I mean, his previous life as director of the State Planning Office, where he led the clarion call for controlling sprawl in the state of Maine, I think speaks to his credentials in addressing this area. Also, he worked very effectively with GrowSmart Maine, and I think he's established a track record of a person that not only understands the notions of sprawl, but has been a sort of a forward thinker in the state of Maine as to how do we address them. So I take your analysis with much more than just a statement by a consultant, and I want to thank you for it. I would like, though, also to has anybody looked at the relationship between the projected infrastructural impacts, particularly the public infrastructural impacts, and the potential generation of property tax revenues? I mean, at the landscape level, what kind of burden, again, discounting, you know, there's going to be hopefully jobs available and then economic activity and all of that, but in terms of just property taxes generated from this type of development, are we anywhere close to seeing a match between infrastructural costs and revenues generated by development here?
Based on staff's requests to the applicant and caution to the applicant that this would be a very major question, just what you've asked, they hired Eastern Maine Development Corporation and then Planning Decisions to do this analysis. And they did an analysis based on a scope of work that we actually designed because we wanted to make sure that this was not a rhetorical fluff piece but actually got down to hard numbers. And those analyses are part of the record. And the conclusion was that the potential tax revenue generation, this all depends on legislative bodies setting mill rates and everything else, but all other things being equal, given today's conditions, the tax revenues generated from property taxes, sales taxes, and income taxes would be many times, multifold, the cost of servicing the proposed development. That was not even. There was some unevenness here in that the unorganized territory and the counties will be especially large-scale beneficiaries of that tax revenue, and other places like Greenville and Jackman, because the development is they will get some spin-off development, but they won't get the direct development, will be marginal beneficiaries of that revenue. So the revenue will be there to pay for the costs of services that this development will demand. The bigger question is, will that revenue reach the specific agencies that need it? Because where those agencies don't have direct control over the revenues being generated, so will the Maine Forest Service get the revenue it needs? Will the Land Use Regulation Commission get the revenues it needs for code enforcement, and so forth? But that's a bigger political decision that is not up to the landowner typically to answer. The revenues will be there if those agencies want to allocate them to the places that are necessary to deliver the services. The resorts themselves will, by the proposal of the applicant and by testimony on the record, pay directly to accommodate the services that they will be demanding, the major services that they will be demanding, and will do that either by providing them themselves or buying those services. There are a couple of areas where I do have concerns, and because I'm not positive how the dollars will be there, but I don't know exactly how the dollars will flow to the place that it has to be to get the job done, and I think primary among those would be the Rockwood Fire Service, which is all volunteer and is a very small department now. A lot of development will occur in its jurisdiction, in its service area, and that development will generate revenues, potentially, to pay for an upgraded fire department. But exactly how you do that, because it's not just equipment that you have to buy, you've got to have the volunteers, people, the human resources. And will those come from the year-round workers that will be attracted to this area because they're building homes and supplying services to the hotels and things like that? Don't know. I think this is a place where at the subdivision level, the commission might want to think about standards or requirements like residential sprinkling and that sort of thing that will reduce some of the public service requirements. But on the whole, there's been a very careful look at this question of community services, revenues, costs, and how the money flows. And we believe that for the purposes of rezoning, there is ample evidence that the development can be served. At the subdivision level, the commission will have to look at this each time and get absolute assurances in writing from the various service agencies, providers, that they will be there to provide services to that particular subdivision.
Evan, back to your overview. This is this question has no real answer, I don't think, but when you did your projections, and I know you probably discussed it, it was probably based on, believe it or not, $3 gasoline, or maybe even $2.50. I don't know when it was done. How, in your mind, does $4 and $5 gasoline play into your overview of this, and is there flexibility in these plans that will allow for this? I mean, it's on everybody's mind in this room. Let's get over that everybody's changing a little bit. So how did you rationalize that, or how do you feel about that? And believe me, like I said, there's no answer. It would be a prediction.
Yes, we did not. It's on everybody's mind, as you say, but we did not condition our review and our recommendations on energy prices simply because it's beyond our capacity to do so. I think from a market point of view, it could have great implications, but I frankly don't know if it's to the benefit of a development like this or to its disadvantage. It could put a big premium on more self-containment, on the capacity to come to a place, park the car, and never have to be in it for any substantial purpose. So the idea of compactness and so forth will play out here just as it does in regular year-round metropolitan areas. It could be a great discouragement to resort developers taking a chance that people will want to drive from Providence, Rhode Island up into the Greenville area for a week-long vacation. I don't know how it will play out. It would take somebody smarter than I am or time for me to really do some careful market analysis as to what the effect would be. I think it's going to put a premium on energy efficiency, on the greenness of the development from single-family homes to the commercial and lodging facilities.
That would be market-driven, so we're trusting the market. But like 300 trips a day, that would go nowhere but down probably with each uptick of the price of gas.
I think that is a good supposition.
Anything else, Gwen?
I guess for me, this is probably a huge issue that I have struggled with a lot, because obviously this development is going to have a huge impact on this region, and trying to make a decision about how much impact, you know, these many units are going to have on this area is, I guess, the one that I'm most anxious about. And I really appreciate that we've got some evidence or some information that's in the record that gives us some guidance on this. I'm wondering, Evan, where is the tipping point? I mean, if this is not it, I mean, what would be the tipping point? And then I also wonder, you know, what other development is going to occur in this area if the ski resort is built, and maybe we can't even take that into consideration, or there's certainly a lot of developable land within Greenville, depending on how they have it zoned. You know, there could be a lot more growth than what we're looking at here in this region. And what's your response to that? Or, I mean, what are your thoughts?
It's a great question. And it's probably not possible for us to exactly quantify it, but I can give you some examples and thoughts. Because we did look at this, both on an area-by-area basis and on an overall basis. Maine Audubon suggested that a tipping point would be 2,000 vehicles per day, AADT, on the road system. In the end, we couldn't find enough evidence to suggest that that was a valid tipping point. The evidence suggested it would be something greater than that in parts of the network, and perhaps 2,000 in other parts of the most the remote parts of the network. But it seemed that for some species, 2,000 is too much, and for some species, it's not really significant. But I would guess that if the evidence was strong, for example, that there would be 3,000 or 4,000 vehicles per day as a result of this development up at Kakajo or beyond or up 20 miles, you would have reached the tipping point. We looked really hard to understand this traffic flow issue and impact on wildlife, and we just couldn't find those levels as measured against the guidelines that we think were established in the record. But that might be a tipping point. It might be a tipping point specifically for Lily Bay, or it might be a tipping point for the entirety of this development. A lot of that depended, you remember, on trip assignment, where Tom Errico estimated that 7.5% of all the traffic generated on Brassway Peninsula and Long Pond would end up going past Lily Bay up to Kakajo on average. Whether that's true or not, I'm very skeptical if it is, but we think that it might be, and it deserves some further analysis as time goes on. But in general, if traffic is one of those metrics that you can see permeating the area and from which you can estimate tipping point, I think that would be fair. And if you're in the 3,000 plus range in these very wildlife sensitive areas, that would be a tipping point. I think another tipping point would be if the amount of development exceeded your metric for surface area of lakes, either individually or cumulatively. What your standard is there should not be more than one shoreline dwelling per 10 surface acres of lakes. Your policy is that once you reach that point, you are inviting conflict on lakes. And this development is way below that in almost every instance. And even if you take a place like Lily Bay and just think of Lily Bay as a lake unto itself, you do not exceed that level. So that's a tipping point that is not exceeded. Some things don't lend themselves to tipping point questions as much as are we avoiding things that can be avoided. So instead of plopping a development right down in the middle of known Canada Lynx territory where there have actually been sightings, you move it out and you put the boundary someplace else. So that's another area. I think the idea of recreation opportunity spectrum is a very interesting mechanism by which you can measure tipping point. And that tipping point will be somewhat subjective. And you have discretion to decide, okay, if it's roaded natural now, as defined in that spectrum, we don't want it to go to the next place. We don't want it to go to rural, where the interaction of inter-recreationists is more common, where the sights and sounds of development are more likely to be unacceptable. But by our calibration, per Anderson and Daigle and Palmer, if the conservation easements are in place covering such a large area, there is the capacity to absorb this additional development and some shift on the spectrum in some very specific places without having reached the tipping point. You have great discretion to decide whether that's so or not. You have great discretion to decide whether development at Big Moose, 800 resort accommodation units, given the vegetation standards that we are recommending, given the limitations on docks, given other the limitations on other things that reduce the impact of that development, nevertheless reaches a tipping point in terms of this recreation opportunity spectrum. So there, this is not a completely unanswerable question, and we did look at these things.
Yeah, I appreciate all of that, really. And I think what I heard Aga say earlier is that all this fits together. In other words, the recommendations that you made for the conservation areas are part of the balance, or the
you
part
cannot
of the picture.
You can't. We're talking about these in isolation, but they cannot be done in isolation. If any of these pieces were missing, if the vegetation standards weren't there, if the easements weren't there, if limitations on docking weren't there, if other things weren't there, then we would be closer to a tipping point potentially.
Okay, thank you.
I'd just like to, I don't know what this is for. We talk about the character of this region and sort of where's the tipping point beyond which we begin to negatively affect the character. And I guess what I'm wondering about is I think character is in the eye of the beholder. I mean, many people have, a sense of what they view of the character of this region to be, but you ask them to put it into words and it gets a little mushy. I have to say, I view the character of this region in a slightly different lens, and I would be surprised if Barton didn't as well. And that is that I view the character of this region over my 60-year lifespan, having lived in that region. And you mentioned the human capacity to run the volunteer fire station at Rockwood. We're losing population. We're losing public capacity in that area. I mean, we have the record is replete with the impacts on the hospital or the potential impacts on the hospital, of schools, the ability to maintain young people in the area, to keep it vital socially and civically. And when I was young, and Bart will attest to it, there were farms and shops. The shops, like, for example, there was a shop in all over the place, shops in Millinocket. There was a shop at Greenville Junction that ran 24 hours a day. It was a blacksmith shop that turned out boom chains and turned out picaroons and turned out cant dogs. And the Pittston farm, there were hundreds of horses there, not just a few. And there were hundreds of men into the woods. Now, granted, because of the less intense forestry at the time, there were fewer people residing in the area. The quality of the environment, one might argue, maybe was enhanced. But when I look at what's going on in that region, it seems to me that part of what needs to be factored in here, and it doesn't seem to get factored in as fully as I'd like to see it, is the idea of what's happening to the people in the region. And there has to be some development there of some sort. And so when I look at development, I'm just not looking at the impact on recreation and the impact on visibility and the impact on wildlife. I'm also looking at, impact on what is becoming a rare, threatened, and endangered species, and that is the residents, the working residents of the Greenville region. So I hate to sound like I'm carrying the baton for, economic development at any cost, because I certainly am not. But I think that the area deserves and can absorb a substantial amount of economic development. And this doesn't even get into the whole thing about when the Kineo House was running and all the different resorts and the vibrancy of the railroads bringing sports in from Boston to New York. Even forgetting that, I think that there's room here for economic development. So I guess I really choke at the number of units. But I think that compared to the lack of economic development, I think that I am willing to at least consider this, particularly, as you pointed out, in light of the very substantial gains in conservation through conservation easements in perpetuity in the area. So I think there's a balance that can be struck, but I look at that sort of that tipping point in a slightly different way, and that's I look at it over the 60-year history as I have seen it of that area, as opposed to a lot of people who have come recently and look at it as it exists today. I don't know if I'm making that point well, but...
Pretty clear to me.
And I'd be interested in your perspective on that, too, Bob.
Yeah. No, I'm sympathetic to what Ed says. I guess that we're probably all... The number of units is obviously one of the most visible aspects of the whole development and one that people have discussed the most and have some have railed at the most and some have supported, obviously. It's the easiest thing to get your hands around. And it is a big number. The question in my mind is, of course, will they ever all get built? In light of the discussions you and Steve had a minute ago, may have some impact. And... But I think that I'm willing to listen to the discussion as we go along here, but I agree with you that all the other aspects of this development have to be in place to make this function. It can't exist on its own. With that, I don't want to cut this discussion off, but Ron had a very specific request to have a break in 2 hours, and so I'm going to honor that. And we'll come back at 3:30, and we'll pick up with this discussion again if we want to.